the Q, the O, and the Dub. Welcome to Junior, the CHL podcast with Jeff Merrick and Sam Cosentino. From now until the MasterCard Memorial Cup, this is the destination for news, opinion, and prospects. No one does the CHL like this.
Well, an historic day around these parts, Sportsnet.ca and iTunes. Welcome to the maiden voyage of Junior, the CHL podcast. I am Jeff Merrick alongside Sam Cosentino, lead analyst for Sportsnet CHL coverage. Sammy, how are you today, bud?
I'm doing great. Nice to be aboard. I don't know how historic it will be, but we're hoping it'll get that way at some point.
Yeah, well, you know, we try to set the bar high here so we have something to leap over. But I mean,
you're the highest bar. Oh, right? You're the highest bar there is.
I'm the low man on the totem pole, and you know that. Thank you very much. You know, it's funny because, Sam, you and I started talking about this about a year ago, about trying to put something like this consistently together to cover off all three leagues in the CHL. And finally today, this thing has come to fruition. And I suppose the first topic up for grabs here on the Junior podcast, the CHL podcast for CHL fans, let's go over a couple of trades that we saw most recently. And we'll talk to Nick Baptiste here in a couple of seconds now of the Erie Otters. But the St. John Sea Dogs, who in a lot of ways, I mean, I thought this was supposed to be a rebuilding year for the Dogs, right? All of a sudden, you know, they have eyes for the MasterCard Memorial Cup in 2017, and that's where they're headed. But they pull off an interesting one this week as well, picking up the rights to Jamie Armstrong from Acadie Bathurst in exchange for a fourth-round pick. Your thoughts on this one?
Well, a couple things, first of all. I mean, a couple of years ago, the Quebec Major Junior Hockey League mandated that X number of American players had to be selected in each of their drafts. And that was to try and increase the influx of players coming to the draft. Now, most of the teams are realists in that regard, that players aren't necessarily going to show up. And so they tend to spend later picks on those types of players. This one is an interesting deal for me because Jamie Armstrong is the son of Bill Armstrong, who's the head scout for the St. Louis Blues. Yep. And I can remember to the second, the day he was drafted, it was at the NHL Combine while the Q draft was on, or very close to it, and just kind of passing me in the hall was Bill Armstrong, and he said, okay, Acadie Bathurst, I'm not so sure my son's going to go that route. And so with St. John making the acquisition, you get into a, you know, you get into an English-speaking market, you get into a team now that has the 2017 sight set, as you talked about. And the other element is you have to wonder what kind of friendship has been forged between Bill Armstrong and Darryl Young, who's the general manager for St. John, who had a lengthy career scouting with the Vancouver Canucks. And you have to wonder if Armstrong doesn't show up here at some point in the near future, maybe not necessarily this year, but somewhere down the road. And that could be a huge move.
You know, I talked to someone in St. John today who said, yeah, we don't expect him certainly this year, and we don't actually even expect him next year. Eyes to have him in the fold for 16-17 when they will have, I mean, when you look at their roster now, they'll have six of their eight defensemen back. They'll probably have six of their 10 forwards back. They're two backup netminders back. They're poised to add another netminder, a kid from the OJHL in Hamilton by the name of Alex Bishop. So this is, and they have like five first-round picks, I think, Sam, in the next 2 to 3 years. So, yeah. I mean, listen, St. John is loaded. This is a wonderful season for the St. John Sea Dogs, and they're really turning heads. I remember talking to someone who was at their training camp, and everybody was saying, you know, expect St. John to be a little bit or even a lot better than everyone expects them to be. But, you know, the interesting thing to me about Jamie Armstrong, and I'm glad you mentioned Bill, you know what I think of when I think of Bill Armstrong is Mike Legg, is the lacrosse goal, because Bill Armstrong was actually the guy that invented it. And he did it, Sam, I want to say three different times when he played with the Albany River Rats of the American Hockey League. They used to always send the video to ESPN, but the videos were so grainy, they could never air it. So Mike Legg gets all the credit for doing the Michigan goal. Meanwhile, it's Bill Armstrong who actually taught Mike Legg, and I believe at a camp in London, how to do that move. But that is actually Bill Armstrong's move that Mike Legg has sort of made popular throughout hockey. But, you know, we
it's
also
funny,
saw
Jeff.
Yep, go ahead.
That you go back, and I remember my big white cell phone that I had at the time. It didn't have the video camera on, and if it did, it wasn't working all that good. That's when Billy would have been playing.
So it's now, I think the kid's going to finish up prep school, and the plan is for him to be in the mix in 16, 17. Although, you know what? Maybe it shouldn't shock us if he jumps in as early as next season. Speaking of St. Louis, we saw a decommit as well. Matthew Tkachuk decommits from NoDak, and he's property of the London Knights. You want to read the tea leaves on that one quickly?
I mean, this is kind of typical. And, you know, it's funny, some of the conversations that have surrounded Mark Hunter, and I remember one as recently as last week in the Subway Series, that, this is going to work out great. I mean, Mark gets the job with the Toronto Maple Leafs, and now he can have the Leafs pay for his scouting trips to recruit players for the London Knights. So it was pretty funny how that worked out. And Mark, you know, kind of took everything in stride. And I suppose there is a, you know, a shred of element of truth in that, as he remains the team owner, or part team owner in that regard. Surely that wouldn't be his first intention in any of what he does. He's such a, you know, a hardworking guy and an honest guy in that regard that you wouldn't expect that. But I mean, this is kind of typical. And the thing is, people oftentimes talk about London and yeah, they get the best players and whatever else. The thing about London is they don't have to work as hard to recruit. I mean, you're playing in a big town. You're playing in a town that's still close to the U.S. border. So if you have American kids, and there's been a lot of them, it's relatively easy for them to get there. If not by driving, then by flights, because it also has an international or at least a large national airport. Mm-hmm. And then you're playing in front of 9,000 people. You're playing in front of a guy who played 19 years in the National Hockey League. And you look at the history of players that have gone on to play there, you know, the recruiting becomes really easy for the London Knights for all of those reasons. And so, you know, a lot of people will talk about some underhanded things and under the table things and so on and so forth. But the fact of the matter is it's a pretty easy place to recruit players to, Jeffy.
Yeah, it certainly is. We'll talk about Mitch Martin and the London Knights a little bit later on in the podcast. We have the London Knights coming up on Friday Night Hockey, facing off against the Erie Otters. One thing we should mention as well about Jamie Armstrong, he's committed to Northeastern so far. I don't know if there's been a decommit there. He's committed for the 16-17 season, but I expect that he'll show up as a member of the Sea Dogs and not end up at Northeastern. Okay, we're going to talk to Nick Baptiste here in a little while here on the podcast. That was a trade as Sudbury starts to spell off. Matthew Campagna goes to Plymouth in the offseason. Now Nick Baptiste goes to the Erie Otters. Some picks go the other way alongside Travis Wood and Cole Mayo. 2 seconds and 2/3, as you know, the Erie Otters, who are now all of a sudden won 3 games in a row. What, do they even need Connor McDavid anymore, for crying out loud? Try to replace, you know, the goals that, you know, used to be on the stick of Dane Fox and Connor Brown and Andre Burakovsky and Brendan Gaunce and the like. So that offense just got, you know, another bullet in their chamber.
Here's the biggest thing. When you look at a hockey team right now that's really relying on 3 17-year-olds and Dylan Strome, Alex DeBrincat, who just turned 17, yep, I believe, and Connor McDavid, who, when he gets back, is obviously the best 17-year-old, soon-to-be 18-year-old player in the world. The fact of the matter is, when you're going into big series in the Western Conference and you're getting push-comes-to-shove type of games played down the stretch and into the playoffs, it's pretty tough to rely on 3 17-year-olds, as good as those guys may be. And so, you know, Sherry Bassin felt that they needed that, a little grit, a little toughness, and still a guy that has the ability to score. And so they were able to do that in one package. I mean, there's no secret what Sudbury's trying to do here. Acquire assets, acquire players was absolutely key for Blaine Smith in the deal there. I like Cole Mayo. Travis Wood is a very serviceable guy who will get top line minutes there in Sudbury, so that works out well. He adds some grit, and so some of the grit that they lost in Baptiste goes back the other way. But Mayo's an interesting player. He's on the C list right now, so a late round projected pick in the National Hockey League draft, and a guy I think has pretty good upside. So it worked out well for Sudbury, and I think when you look at the Erie Otters, that is one key move. I think there's still a couple more left in the tank before they feel really confident about moving forward and making a deep run into the spring.
You know, we'll talk to the young man who, as you mentioned, is a draft pick of the Buffalo Sabres here in a couple of moments. But I'm curious, and maybe the answer is quite simple. Well, it was Trent Cull that got to him, but here's a guy coming out of the Ottawa Senators minor midget AAA program, joins the Ontario Hockey League. He's a big-bodied guy. He's got a lot of skill. I mean, and in a lot of ways, he was pure offense, but he has really turned into, as you very well know, Sam, the prototypical 200-foot player in the Ontario Hockey League.
You know, Jeff, I watched him last year at the Subway Super Series, and there was no question in my mind that he should have earned an invite to Canada's National Junior Camp last year. Now, when they turned the reins over to Brent Sutter, he wanted to do things his way. They thought that, you know, with the success he'd had in the past, that they'd give him some leeway to do things his way. He had a real small camp. Baptiste wasn't invited, should have been, and quite frankly, might have been able to make that team. This year in the Subway Super Series, not quite as good as last year, but I think the overall game and some of the memories going back to the under 18 sits well at top of mind with Hockey Canada. So the other, you know, you're getting a solid, solid player. And the other thing is, I like it when moves are made previous to the deadline, because you want to integrate the player into your team, get him used to coaching. You know, there's going to be that Christmas break coming up, whether he's gone with the World Junior team or not. You still want to integrate guys early on. And I think it worked pretty well last year, because if I'm not mistaken, it was a late November trade that brought Brendan Gaunce over from Belleville to get to Erie, and was the same sort of thing. I remember having that conversation, and they want to be able to integrate the guy into the system, get used to Chris Knobloch, get used to new line mates, billets, schooling, all that sort of stuff. And so Sherry Bassin goes out and does it again.
And Bassin has mentioned he's like the player going back to when he played minor midget with the Ottawa system. You mentioned the World Juniors, and the camp is around the corner, Sam, and there'll be upwards of 32 kids invited. Some question marks about some NHLers, and do they come back? Obviously a big no to Aaron Ekblad. But where do we put players like Curtis Lazar? Where do we put players like Jonathan Drouin? Where do we put players like Anthony Duclair? How many of these guys do you think are made available for service for the World Junior Championships this year?
Boy, oh boy. And then the news today about Bo Horvat. So it doesn't look like he's going to be available for loan. And the other guys are playing decent minutes. I mean, when you're talking about, you know, 19-year-old guys that are 18, 19-year-old guys that are playing, you know, 12, 13 minutes in the case of Duclair and Lazar. I mean, Drouin's minutes have kind of, they've gone up and down, but when they're all averaging in that neighborhood, and they're all producing fairly well. I don't know. I don't like the chances there of any of those guys being let go. You have to think back to Devontae Smith-Pelly when he was injured at the World Juniors, and Anaheim kind of had him, and then there was some limbo questions there, and that will, you know, sit at top of mind for general managers. And really, at the end of the day, while everyone would like to be loyal to Canada when there's Canadian management involved, at the end of the day, your job as a general manager is to put the best club on the ice every night. And if that means a Lazar, a Drouin, or a Duclair is in there, in order to do that, then that's your first priority. And I think that has to be respected by Hockey Canada.
We should talk as well when it comes to WJC's. Connor McDavid still injured. He is skating with the Erie Otters, taking light shots as well. Saw the hand specialist in just outside of Toronto, I believe, on Tuesday. He's back in Erie skating with the team and working out. But Hockey Canada is prepared to wait to the very last possible second to bring Connor McDavid on, true or false?
I'd say absolutely. I think really that when you look at the guys that are available right now, and I'm not including any of the NHL guys, that I feel really strongly that this team is going to be challenged to score goals. And I think McDavid obviously would be a huge, huge piece to that. You know, the other thing too is, Jeff, what do good teams have? Strength down the middle. And Sam Reinhart and Connor McDavid definitely give you that when it comes to your top six. And you can debate who would be the number one center there. Likely Reinhart, just because he's a little older. But then again, does it really matter? You're forcing the other team to match up against those two centermen, and that's going to be difficult for any country. So there's no doubt in my mind that they'll wait until the very last possible second to see if McDavid will be good to go.
Who else did put
your
down in the middle?
What do you think?
Well,
what do you think, Jeff?
Well, they're gonna wait till the last possible second. I mean, if McDavid is good to go, and the first thing that I heard a day after the injury, I talked to someone close to the McDavid camp, and I says, "What does this mean for the WJCs?" And he told me, he said, oh, he's playing. Like, it was like, he's gonna recover, and he's going to be fine. He's going to be playing in the World Junior Hockey Championships. Make no mistake about it. The question I have is, you know, there's a number of names out there, and we saw Frederick Oche last year drawing fourth line minutes for Team Canada. There are other players. Robbie Fabry's name comes to mind as well. I'm curious to see who, if it's going to be Reinhart and McDavid 1-2, who's 3 and 4? Because there's no shortage of options out there.
And
you can, and you can go to Portland for the obvious choice there. I mentioned, you know, Gauthier. I think Robbie Fabry would be an outstanding choice. And then there are the players that weren't wanted on the Voyage last year. And I'm thinking of Max Domi and Darnell Nurse. Is this their time to finally crack this Team Canada lineup?
And I'd
have
so.
I'd have to say yes on both.
Yeah, I would too, Jeff. You know, on the Subway Super Series, I think both guys played really well. I think for Darnell Nurse, it's been a real coming of age, you know, getting into a couple of National Hockey League games in the middle of October and really heeding the advice of going back and playing the kind of game that he's going to be able, that he's going to have to play at the next level. That's a simple game. That's a physical game. That's defending the net type of game, and worry about the offense later. That stuff will come. Mm-hmm. But that shouldn't be a first priority for a guy like Darnell Nurse. And I think it was last year, and I think that hurt him. Yeah. But watching him in the Subway Super Series, you know, great man-on-man play. Up off the glass if there wasn't an option. Ability to skate it out when he saw fit to do so and pick good spots in which to do that. And when it comes to Domi, you know, you talk about all the guys at center. Maybe Domi becomes that guy at center. For me, Frederick Gauthier is the fourth. He starts as the fourth line guy. And to be perfectly honest with you, Jeff, I think he's going to be in tough. I really, really do. I mean, when he plays with his max energy, he's really good. But I think finding that on a consistent every shift basis has been a bit of a challenge for him this year. Yes, he was hurt, that sort of thing. But, you know, even as an incumbent, I still think he comes back as the four guy. And I think when you look at this year's World Junior team, Ryan Jankowski, and they talk about skill, it's a Domi, it's a Fabry, it's a Patan. It's one of those three guys that's going to end up being the third line center, I think, after Reinhart and McDavid.
Let's go back to Darnell Nurse here for a quick second, because you mentioned the Subway Super Series, and you know, obviously you were there this year, you and RJ, and last year as well. I can remember it was the game in Oshawa, and I talked to someone in the coaching staff, and we were talking specifically about Darnell Nurse, and this was a pivotal game for him. This was Hockey Canada's chance to have a look at him in the big pressure situation, facing off against the Russians, and what was he going to do? And Hockey Canada wanted a very simple, safe game from Darnell Nurse, and that might have given him that final push to make the World Junior squad. But he didn't give them that game. It almost seemed as if Darnell Nurse was trying to force things, do too much, be a player that he couldn't be at the uppermost level of the international stage. How much did that game in Oshawa last year, the Subway Super Series, hurt Darnell Nurse's chances of making the World Junior squad? And how much did his play this year absolve him of what he did last season?
Yep. You're bang on the money. You know, and getting a chance to travel with those Hockey Canada guys, you know, you have some good conversations with everyone on the coaching staff, from Dave Lowry to Scott Walker and Marty Raymond, and of course Benoit Grew. So you have those conversations about guys and, you know, and how they've evolved and that sort of thing. And for Nurse, that's just it. I mean, why not take your game and mold it to be the game that it's going to have to be at the next level? And I think for Nurse, he was, you know, he was allowed to run free and do things on Sault Ste. Marie and get away with them and do them very successfully that he's not going to be able to do in the National Hockey League. And so, again, getting into camp, maturing physically, even though he didn't need much of that, but mentally, I think was huge for him. And I think you're exactly right. He absolved there. And you know, there's a lot of people out there that don't put a ton of stock into those games. But I can give you three names of guys who used single Subway Super Series games to make Team Canada. Wayne Simmonds, Stefan De La Rivière, and Marcus Foligno. All three were guys that, in their respective Subway Super Series games, some as replacements, some as guys who were given just one opportunity, performed above and beyond their expectations and all played a similar type of role playing for Hockey Canada on the World Juniors, that physical energy type role. And I'm not saying Darnell Nurse is going to be that guy, but the point that I'm trying to make is that indeed one game can make a difference.
Curious about your thoughts on a few guys that may have long shot chances at making Team Canada, but have chances nonetheless. We think of Joe Hicketts with Victoria, who's got a shot at the blue line. We think of the Western Hockey League's version of Brendan Gallagher and Jace Haralock with the Brandon Wheat Kings. Nick Paul of the North Bay Battalion. Braden Point might be one of those guys as well. Who are some of your dark horses to make this squad? Those would be mine that would come to mind.
I think Point makes it. He is so servable. Jeff, every scout talks about consistency. This guy, to me, has one of the most consistent games in general terms, of any player I've seen in a long time. He gives you the same effort. He does the same things. He makes guys around him better. He produces, and it doesn't matter on what stage and on what level and what the competition is. This guy is remarkably consistent. And when it comes to Point, this guy can play anywhere you want. You want him to play fourth line? No problem. You want him to be a checking guy? Yeah, no problem. And if you maybe want him to dazzle a little bit, he'll do that. So to me, Point's on the team. I really feel that strongly about his game. The one other guy that you didn't mention, and I know you're going to be really happy about this, is Lawson Crouse out of Kingston. It's not often that he get a 17-year-old guy or a guy in his draft year who's a big body guy who plays with that type of energy, who can play on the kill for you, which I think he would give you serviceable minutes, if not in the number one PK unit, probably the number two unit. But he's a guy who, to me, is a dark horse. And I love the guys that you mentioned. I'm in agreement with all of those. But I'm not so sure I'd call Braden Point a dark horse. I think he's going to be a member of that club. I really do.
I know you like Nick Paul a lot, and we talked about him last year during Friday Night Hockey a couple times, you and me, Sam. What do you think of his shot?
Interesting. Plays the wing, big guy, shoots the puck a ton. I think there are some challenges with consistency in his game, but I will say this, and I trust the words of Stan Butler. I spent a lot of time with him over the years in Brampton, sitting in his office before games, just shooting the breeze. And he's a guy who said to us last year before, I think it was game two or three against Guelph in the OHL Championship, and said, you know what? I've talked to Hockey Canada, and I've strongly made a push for Nick Paul. And both RJ and I kind of looked at one another, not having seen a ton of him at that point, but definitely having come to respect him after the OHL Championship Series. And obviously he had a good summer camp, and that size always plays. So if he can come into camp and be consistent shift in and shift out, he's a guy who I think has a shot. But I think right now I would definitely deem him as a dark horse player.
Okay, last one for this segment. The net mining, pretty safe to assume Zach Fucali is there. Who's there after Fucali, the Halifax netminder?
It'll be the same four guys that went to the summer camp. I mean, the one concern I would have is Philip DeRocher. I didn't really like his game in the Subway Super Series, and he had everything going for him in that game. He had the rest because he got to play the second game. He was playing in front of the home crowd. He was playing in a rink in which he was comfortable, and I don't think he performed particularly well. So not that I don't think it'll matter. I think the two guys that I see kind of moving forward are Fricali. I mean, he's an incumbent. And so that's, it's pretty tough to be removed from that role, even though we've talked about Gauthier as being an incumbent, maybe, not being a guy who's back this year, but that's another story. But when it comes down to the goaltending, I think Fucali, and I like Tristan Jarry, and here's why. Tristan Jarry is a guy who, going back to the 2012 year, had spent time as a backup to Lauren Brossoit. Lauren Brossoit at that time was expected to be one of three netminders that Canada was going to take across in order to have that extra guy so that they wouldn't have to fly a guy across the, halfway across the world to get there. That never happened. Brossoit never made it. And so Jarry had to kind of sit patiently and continue to be the backup. Watch his team go through that first MasterCard Memorial Cup in Schwenningen in 2012, and then kind of become that guy and evolve as a top-notch goaltender, and then winning championship last year. So in terms of a guy who could go in as a backup and not be rattled in coming in any situation, his past experiences serve him well for that. And the other thing is, in the international game, without the lines behind the net, he's going to have the opportunity to play the puck. And I think that'll be a huge asset, despite what I expect to be a real good the puck moving defensive core back there, but he can really act as that third defenseman should he get into games. And so those are the two guys I'd be looking at. But I still think that the same four end up going to the World Junior Camp. I'll say this though, Jeff, there are two disappointments to me when it comes to the goaltending. The first would be that Philip Cadoret, Bay Como, never got a sniff. Mm-hmm. And the other would be Ken Appleby. It's hard to deny the numbers he's put up with an Oshawa team that has well exceeded expectations this year. And he didn't get a sniff, although he was the backup to Spencer Martin in game one of the OHL portion of the Subway Super Series. You know, Hockey Canada, they're an interesting animal at times in that they kind of get set in their ways and thinking about players in a different way in which they've seen them in the past can at times be a challenge for Hockey Canada. And so those are two guys that necessarily have not been on the radar in the past, who I would have liked. I think that's what the Subway Super Series is for, is exactly those type of players, to see them under pressure, to see them under siege, playing against that high-level competition four lines deep. That's what, to me, the Subway Super Series games are for. I think you're pretty confident what you're going to get with Fucali and Jari and Carmi. You know those guys. Those are known commodities. Give the unknown commodities a shot every now and then just to see if they can maybe change your mind or give you pause for thought, if nothing else. And so when it comes to the goaltending situation, I think one of those two guys might have been able to challenge Phil DeRocher for that fourth spot in what I expect to be the same four guys that went to the summer camp.
And the one thing we do know about Tristan Jarry as well, in the most pressure game of all last season, the MasterCard Memorial Cup final, even though he gave up the Fabry goal early, he was clutch. As much as we talk about the Samuelson line really driving what Edmonton did last year, so much of that game that we saw in London, Sam, was, of course, about Tristan Jarry. Camp opens next week.
He doesn't get rattled, right? I mean, Jeff, you're sitting there in the rink. He gives up a bad goal to start. You're thinking, oh, boy.
No problem.
No problem. He just battles back. And that's the type of mentality you need in that event.
And they're loving that in Pittsburgh. He is one of their prospects.
I'm Steven Stamkos of the Tampa Bay Lightning. I played for the Sarnia Sting in the OHL.
Well, Sammy, our next guest is a Buffalo Sabres prospect and the newest member of the Erie Otters. We'll see him Friday as part of Friday Night Hockey as the Otters face off against the London Knights. He is former Sudbury Wolves standout Nick Baptiste. He joins us now on the Junior Podcast. Nick, thanks so much for doing this. How are you today?
I'm good. My pleasure. Happy to be here.
The pleasure is ours. First of all, were you surprised by the trade earlier on this week?
A little bit. I mean, obviously with Sudbury in a rebuild, there was an option where I could go to a contending team and they could get some assets in return. So when the opportunity arose and I was able to get the chance to join a number one ranked Erie team, it was something that I wasn't going to turn down. So I'm excited to be here.
I'm fascinated that during the process, how much is Blaine or Paul Fixture, how much are they involved with you saying, here's kind of what's happening, or are you just left out of the mix altogether until it's done?
They've been really good with me. We met throughout the week, 2 weeks ago, and then once this week, and he kind of said that we're fielding offers, obviously, and then when one that they liked, Rye from Erie, they were open to letting me know about it and asking if I was able to waive my no trade if I'd like to, and obviously I wasn't going to say no to that opportunity, so it was exciting for me.
Any friends on the team? Anyone you know already, or is it a bunch of new guys for you?
Well, I played with Corey Genovese in Sudbury when he was in Sudbury, and then I also played with McDavid with Connor at U18s two summers ago, so I know those two guys, and I've been here for a day, and I'm already making pretty good progress beating and talking to guys, so it's been really good.
Yeah, that under-18s, I thought to me, I've been very vocal about your Subway Series last year, and I thought you should have been invited to Canada's World Junior Camp and maybe even been a part of that team last year, but even going back to that under-18s, to me, that was like the epitome of your game for me. I mean, you did a little bit of everything, a little bit on the kill, hard-working, physical game, still able to produce. I mean, to you and where you are with your career, how did you view that under-18s and where you've come from since then?
It was a great experience. I mean, I thought that at the end of the season, I had a strong end of my season with Sudbury and carried that on to under-18s, and I was able to get the opportunity to be put in a lot of situations, and I thought I thrived throughout that, and I think you know, for me, it was an unbelievable honor being able to win a gold medal and then, you know, carry on into the draft process and then to my good season last year. So I think it was just kind of a snowball effect, but definitely was a great stepping stone for the U18s with me.
And, you know, coming out of the Ottawa program, a lot of people said, you know, highly skilled guy, a lot of offense, and then all of a sudden you turned into, Sam and I were talking about this earlier, you turned into this really good two-way player, the prototypical 200-foot hockey player in the OHL. How much did Trent Cull and Dave Bell have a significant effect on changing your game and shaping your game to make it more complete?
They were good. I mean, we had a lot of older players on our team. My 2 years spent with Trent and Dave, so I wasn't in the top six role, so I needed to find a way to earn my ice time, and to do so, I needed to be good on my own end. So I think that really helped me develop, because when I was able to jump into a top six role, I had my offense still, and I was able to apply that defensive side to my game, and like you guys said, to 200-foot game.
Nick, you've got a wonderful story. We spent some time with you last year. There's a lot of people that don't know about where you've come from, when you started, your parents' involvement in getting you to play the game. Can you kind of go through that for us? You know, and I think it's a good inspiration, especially to some of the younger people out there who realize that you don't have to start at age two or three. But I think your story is fascinating. Can you tell us a little bit about your background, how you got involved, when you started playing, and your parents' involvement?
Yeah, well, my dad Ralph was born in Haiti, so he's never played hockey. My mom, born in Canada, never really played hockey either, so I was not a hockey player to start with, but I was in love with the game, and from the day I was started skating, I think when I was about 7 years old, just in the outdoor rink with my dad, I just wanted to play so bad, so he got me a cheap pair of skates, and I just started skating around, and he always told me about how I always wanted to go on the big ice, and I always couldn't because I was too small, so I would be on the side rink. And then started getting organized hockey at only, I think I was 8 turning 9 years old, so that was the only time I really started. So a little later, but, I mean, still young, my parents just said when I got on the ice, I just loved to play. I wouldn't get off of it.
Who were your favorite players growing up then? Who are the guys that really inspired you?
I was a big Matt Sundin fan. He was a big inspiration for me, and then Jerome McGinley as well. Both those two guys were really influential, and I'd love to watch those guys play.
So let's bring this thing back to the present, the here and now. You get into some practice time with the Erie Otters. First of all, who are you going to be playing with? And secondly, what do you think about the team that you're now on?
Well, right now, it's unbelievable playing with the skilled guys on this team. It's, you know, you look down the roster and they have so many good players. It doesn't even matter who you're playing with. So, for me, it's just to bring my talents and then bring what I bring to the table to this team and make them even more successful than they already are.
What are the main differences then, stylistically? Maybe the way that they're coached, the way the program is handled. What are the differences? I know it's early for you, but the differences between the Sudbury program and the Erie program.
I mean, there's no real differences. You know, both programs were great to me, and I thank the Sudbury Wolves so much for what they've done. And in Erie, I've been here for 2 days, and it seems like I'm part of the family already. So for me, it's not so much comparing the two, just more being happy and blessed to be part of both organizations.
A little closer to Buffalo now, that must make you happy so that they can continue to keep a watchful eye, as they did when you were in Sudbury anyways, but just being a little closer, is that beneficial to you, you think?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I hope they are able to come to more games now that I'm a little bit closer. But that said, I know that their scouting staff is great scouting staff, and they're unbelievable and picking players and keeping in touch with their players. So whether I was here or back in Sudbury still, I know how good they are with keeping tabs on me, so... Yeah, yes, it's nice that it's not as long a trip for them, but I'm sure that whether I was here in Erie or back in Sudbury, that they would still be keeping tabs on me. But it's definitely nice to be a little bit closer.
In your mind, Nick, what areas of the game do you still need to work on?
I think it's a little bit of everything. I don't think I'm perfect at anything, so I've got to, you know, continue to work offensively and work on maintaining my speed and shoring up my own end. All those little things that make players great, I got to continue to do those things so I can continue to excel and keep getting better.
You get a chance to get into some action against Mississauga, and then we've got you on Friday Night Hockey. What's the week look like for you, and is it good kind of just to jump right in this situation that you're in?
Yeah, I think that's the best thing for me, is just to get into a game situation. The coaches have been great with systems for me and being able to learn the way Erie plays and the systems that we have in place. So I'm excited to put that finally into a game and definitely be on national TV on Friday.
Well, we look forward to it at SportsCenter. Hopefully you have your big Rob Falds moments either before the game or during one of the intermissions. Well,
for sure.
We'll catch up down the road. Best of luck with the Erie Otters, Nick. Thanks for doing this, guys.
Appreciate it.
Hi, I'm Dion Phaneuf of the Toronto Maple Leafs. I played my junior hockey for the Red Deer Rebels of the Western Hockey League.
All right, time now for a CHL alumni segment. This gentleman played 15 seasons in the NHL, played 3 seasons with the Medicine Hat Tigers of the Western Hockey League. You can watch him on Calgary Flames games where he's lead analyst. You can also watch him on Hockey Night in Canada. No stranger to hockey fans anywhere. He is our man, Kelly Rudy. Kelly, how are you today, sir?
You know, Jeff and Sam, I'm terrific. I'm really looking forward to this segment because my memories of junior hockey are just the best.
Well, and listen, you had a really nice career playing 3 years with Medicine Hat, but I want to actually start before that. I want to start in Edmonton and how you fell in love with, A, playing Nets, and true or false, and I think the answer is true, is it true that Ken Hitchcock once sold you a pair of goalie pads?
Okay, well, I'll address the first one. You know, I played goal. I was like everybody. You know, you're playing ball hockey and stuff. I didn't start organized hockey until I was actually 12, but leading up to that, playing ball hockey and stuff, and you know how you just, everybody rotates to play goal, you play out and all that kind of stuff, and then the year before I played organized hockey, I asked my parents if I could play, and they gave me great advice. They said, yeah, you can join, but you have to take a year and learn how to skate. So it was during that year, my friend and I were playing ball hockey again in his backyard, and his dad happened to be around, and we were having this conversation about what position I might want to play. He was already a defenseman on the team I was hoping to join. And the dad said, well, you know what, Kelly, I don't want to influence you too much, but whenever I watch you guys play ball hockey, all the local neighborhood kids, you just seem to stop more balls than everybody else. And I did love the position. And so I took it upon those words, really, to go and try the very first practice when I was 12 years old. The community league in which I grew up in, and I just absolutely love it, Elmwood, if you didn't have the equipment, they would lend it to you for the year. And my parents, there's not a chance, could have afforded the equipment back then. So, but unfortunately, there was a problem. So the very first practice I ever had playing on a team as a goaltender, I had no equipment. So I just went out there with skates. Ooh. I had used skates. They didn't even have a hard toe on the for protection. That's how old and beaten up the skates were. But anyways, when I started to get to the pads the next couple practices, I use this word often, Jeff and Sam, talking about playing goal, and it never changed from the day I started until the day I quit in 1998. I just found it to be intoxicating because every day is different. Every situation, although they might look familiar, the circumstance might be different. It's just a really cool thing to go through. And then moving forward, when you said that about Ken Hitchcock, he sold me more than just a pair of pads. He was like a sounding board for me. Back then, I was wearing or hoping to wear Cooper equipment, and my community league occasionally would let me buy some new stuff. Normally, it was just hand-me-downs. And Ken and I have reminisced about this often, just about how he would help me. Mark Messe used to go in there a lot and get his equipment. Clint Malarchuk, you're familiar with his story lately.
Wow, of course.
Yeah.
Beautiful story how he's fighting for every day, and Ken was a big part of his life too. So it was called United Cycle. It was on White Avenue in Edmonton at the time. They've since moved, but just the most pleasant of memories. Thanks for letting me share that.
Wow, that's pretty neat. I mean, you just never think that the roots kind of go back that far, and I guess kind of bringing it full circle, and we'll get to the Medicine Hat experience in a minute, but a lot like catchers in baseball. Goalies have become great broadcasters like yourself. The game is always in front of them. You think that's part of the reason why?
I do. And to be a great goaltender, you need a lot of qualities, I guess. You know, you need reflexes. You need calm when there's pressure and all that. But more than anything, you need to read a play. And you can be an okay goaltender, but you can't really get to a higher level unless you can learn to read a play. Not just what in all probability will happen, but the other two or three options. And I think that's why a lot of guys that play goal go on to being broadcasters, because not only is it what you're watching and seeing unfold, but the other possibilities, and you have to be aware of that. And it, like you said, Sam, it is all in front of you for the most part, other than when dirty, rotten scoundrels like Wayne Gretzky decides to jump behind the net, and then that changes everything. But for the most part, you're just watching everything and trying to drink it all in and learn.
Let's get to the Medicine Hat Tigers, because it's such a wonderful era for junior hockey as well, with a combination of high skill and some brawn as well. I mean, it was a very tough league when you played from 1977 to 1980. This was 81. Was it 80 or 81 that you played to in the Western Hockey?
Yep.
77 to 81. So 77-78 was that first season. That was the year where Brandon had, you know, Prop and Allison and Boschman. Was that the greatest combination you ever played against? And how intimidating was that as a rookie?
It was, but, you know, Jeff, I can go back just a hair. So that summer, back then, if you guys remember, and this is really testing everybody's memory, but you weren't drafted. There wasn't a junior draft. So I actually received two letters for junior tryouts. So the new U.S. Minister Bruin sent me a letter.
Oh, boy.
And the Medicine Hat Tigers. And the Bruins were a powerhouse. So I knew there was no chance there. So I chose the Medicine Hat Tigers because they were in a rebuild. But my real goal, Jeff and Sam, was not to make the Medicine Hat Tigers. I wanted to make the St. Albert Saints and the Alberta Junior Hockey League because I thought that might be the highest level I could make. So much to my surprise, on the second day of training camp in Medicine Hat, Vic Stasiak, and you guys will remember Vic from the famous Uke line when he played for the Boston Bruins and when he was on a line with Johnny Busick and Bronco Horvat. And so he was a legendary coach. He called me into his office the second day, and I'm fully expecting to get cut because I got cut everywhere, like my entire life. I had never played hockey. I was 17 at that time. I'd never played a year up until that point without getting cut at least once, twice, sometimes three times in the fall until I found out what level I was going to play at. So Vic calls me in, and within about 2 minutes, he tells me that I've made the Tigers. So first time ever in my life, I've gone to a training camp, and I'm not cut. That shocked the heck out of me. And secondly, I said, we've got a major problem, because I thought I was getting cut, so I only brought one pair of jeans and two T-shirts. So we get through that, and then because Vic was such a beautiful man, and with his status and what he's gone through in the game of hockey, he talked to me, I bet, for about the next hour and 55 minutes about Terry Sawchuk and Glenn Hall and the other great goaltenders that he had played with. So I was enamored with this conversation. I couldn't get enough of it. But anyways, we get through camp, and then our first road trip was to Brandon to play the Wheat Kings. Mm-hmm. And Jeff and Sam, if my memory serves me well, I could be off just a little bit, but I think we got smoked like 16-1 the first game, and we really cut it down the next game. I think we lost like 12 or 14 to nothing or something. So that was my first experience. I remember getting back to Medicine Hat, busing home, and my parents, of course, no internet and all that, but they read the newspaper and saw the score, box score, and they said, are you okay?
I mean, neck's a little sore.
If you go back to Hockey DB, you'll see my numbers that first year. And I tell kids this all the time. If I can make the National Hockey League, anybody can. Because my goals against average that first year was 6.17. Now, in fairness, it's kind of like joking. But in fairness, we had a really young team. For the most part, everybody was a 17-year-old. Had a couple of 19-year-olds. And we just took it on the chin. I think we had 15 wins all year, maybe about 50 losses. I ended up being the Rookie of the Year on the team awards and also the MVP. So I just got pelted with shots. Some nights we'd go into buildings, and I'm not exaggerating. We'd go into Portland, and I'd get 110 shots and stuff. So I was either going to make it or I was going to be a miserable failure.
Well, you know what? Kelly, it set you up great for the Easter Epic when you and Mason dueled, because that was just like playing the first year in Medicine Hat again. Hey, what was it? I'm curious, what was it like? You've told me these stories before, and they're such great ones. You know, you had a very rookie team in Medicine Hat, a lot of young players. What was it like playing against the new Westminster Bruins head coach Ernie McLean, the legend? And there's some skilled players, certainly. There's, you know, John O'Grodnik, and there's Smeal. Like, there's some skilled guys there. But there's also J.P. Kelly. There's also Boris Fistrick. What are those times like? Any stories to share there?
They were frightening. I remember, there's no question. I didn't face the same sort of situation that the skaters did on my team. But like I said, we were a young team. So going into Queen's Park in New Westminster was a scary moment for a lot of my teammates because, as you said, they were skilled. But man alive, they were the bullies on the block. And you guys are going to laugh at this. Young kids today won't be able to fathom this, but they used to do three things, the Bruins in warm-up. So I'd be
I know where you're going.
Pardon me?
I know where you're going with this.
You do. They would do three things. They'd come down and they'd shoot on me. Okay, so the other team shooting on me in warm-up. They'd take all of our pucks, so we had no pucks. And lastly, they'd come and take our net. So.
Yeah, I knew that one was coming.
And we're young kids. I mean, and typically, like, if I don't know how you could ever research this, but man alive, we had a million brawls in those first 2 years, and we did stick up for ourselves. But that was one building, really, that we were mismatched. So, and it's funny you mentioned Boris Pfister, because I got to know him quite well in the summers, because he also is from Edmonton. So after that first year, we would skate in the summer and stuff, and man alive, he was such a good guy, but he was just such a bully on the ice, but I got to see a different side of him, so I was really actually quite happy to see his son Mark make it, and he's battling back from a back injury right now, Mark is.
It's fascinating to me, because you hear those stories, and the other part is, you know, some of the stuff you used to hear, you know, they come down and take shots on you, obviously, but they use the whole ice to do their warm-up, as opposed to just the half ice. And it's funny, now you have two linesmen out there for every warm-up, and if there's any sort of infraction, you're seeing penalties called before games, and you know, the taking of the net, though, that to me is an all-time classic. But, you know, Kelly, getting back to those old days, one of the coolest things for me, and I've had the opportunity to do it twice, does the number 4,006 ring a bell to you? That number is the 4, capacity 000. Of the Met. That's the capacity of the Medicine Hat Arena, which to me is one of the coolest places to witness a junior game. And you've obviously played a number of games in there. I mean, what's that like? I mean, I look at the attendance now. You don't even have to look at the attendance. You just see 4006 Medicine Hat Arena. I mean, it's unbelievable.
You know, and I think going back then, it was just a touch smaller. I think they've been able to add like 500 more people since when I played. And, you know, I will say this, like, I loved it. And it was a cool experience being kind of like the big man on campus in Medicine Hat, because I was the only sort of game at that level. But I probably, because I was 17 years old when I first started, left when I was 19, I bet I didn't truly appreciate the uniqueness of that. I knew that it was a rocking building, and I knew it was fantastic and so on, but it would have been later on in life, looking back, that you go, geez, I mean, that is just a magical building, and it was intimidating for the other teams. I mean, not my first year, because we weren't a very good team, but we turned around my second and third year, and we were a really good team. We ended up getting to the Eastern Conference Finals my second year, so it's quite a turnaround when you go from 15 wins to the Eastern Conference Finals the next year. But the other thing that was great, guys, and I've always said this, is that when you go from, say, growing up community league hockey in Edmonton, you get to play major junior hockey at that time, and that's your first real experience of being so-called recognized. Now, I'm not going to tell you people coming up for autographs all the time, but your small exposure to that, and it really hit home one time. I can't recall if it was my first or second year, but I was with our captain, Kurt Broadhead, and we're in the local mall, and one of the longtime season seat holders came up to Kurt because he recognized him, and he was talking about the game last night. I guess we didn't play very well, or at least I didn't. And the season seat holder didn't recognize me and said something like, well, that wasn't a bad game last night, but boy, did Rudy ever stink, or something like that. I was like, holy, this is my first experience with negativity and feedback and all that kind of stuff. So, and you get it in just small little doses, which was kind of good, because once you start to move up, you get to the minors, you hear more of it. And then, of course, when you get to the National Hockey League, there's all sorts of criticism being thrown your way, and you sort of learn to deal with it in a small way in junior.
Yeah, I've always wanted to ask you, Kelly, I'm not, maybe we've talked about this player before, maybe we haven't. A gentleman who's from Alberta, he's Canadian, was a centerman with your Medicine Hat Tigers teams, led your team in scoring for a couple of years. Steve Sugiura, you remember Steve?
So Steve Sugiura.
Yeah, so the story goes, he's playing with Maine in the American Hockey League. Mike Milbury is his head coach and his general manager. And they're playing in Sherbrooke. And the organist is a guy by the name of, and no relation to the Quebec goaltender, Mario Gosselin.
Right.
And every time he hits the ice, he plays like what's perceived to be, and rightfully so, some pretty racist oriental music, or he's playing Turning Japanese by the Vapors, or something like that.
Right.
So Milbury's had enough, and he jumps over the glass and charges up to the organist booth. We all make a big deal about Mike Milbury and the shoe at MSG. Didn't actually hit the guy, but Mike went up there and actually accosted the organ player over that. I've never, but it was a legendary story in the American Hockey League. But what was Steve like? Like, what was he like as a hockey player, and how much of that did he face in the Western League?
You know what? I don't recall a situation in the Western Hockey League where that ever happened, but I had heard that story when he played in the American Hockey League. By the way, he had a tremendous American Hockey League career. You look at his numbers, especially when he played for the Maine Mariners, and he was absolutely unbelievable. You know what? The thing with Steve is that it's not sad because he's doing really well. He's a terrific guy, but it's a shame, really, that size was an issue with him back then, and that they decided because he was 5'6", 165, they listened, but he was closer to 180. He was really, really muscular. In today's NHL game, he would play because his skill set was so high, and you, as you guys know, there are a bunch of guys in today's game that we call undersized, and they can play because it's a different game. But back then, he wasn't allowed, so he flourished in the American Hockey League. It's really a shame that it was that type of era for him because he really should have had a long NHL career. He was a terrific guy, great player, and I'm really glad to hear, and I had heard that long ago, about Milbury sticking up for him.
You know, just quickly before we end the interview, Kelly, would you have played with Oren Kulas?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. What was that like? Do you guys still keep a relationship? Obviously, his son, Miles, is still playing. Has been moved from Medicine Hat. But do you guys still keep a relationship?
Yeah, we do. We text every once in a while. Oren was from Chicago, I believe, originally, and he came up to play for the Medicine Hat Tigers. And he was a really skilled guy. I think the nature of the Western Hockey League might have been something that he wasn't very used to, because I doubt that in around the Chicago area that he would have seen that kind of hockey, you know, the brutality of it and every man for himself and, you know, all these different brawls. So I think that was an eye-opener for him. But I remember him as a really skilled winger, great speed, great hands, and so on. You know what he had, and so I'm not surprised he's done really well in the entertainment field with the Saw movies and Two and a Half Men and all that kind of stuff. Back then, for all of us really struggling young boys with not much confidence and stuff, he had swagger. Like, he really believed in himself, and he carried himself like he was going to do great things in life. It was also interesting because, as you said, his son Miles was on the Medicine Hat Tigers, and Miles had the Movember thing going, I think it might have been like 2 years ago. And so our nephew also, Curtis Volk, was playing on the team at the time. So the entire team was challenging people. And, you know, you'd go on everybody's list, and there'd be like somebody's aunt and uncle supporting the junior player for $50 and all this. And it was all great and worthwhile. And so we added our name to Curtis Volk. Well, we looked at the list for Miles Kulas. It's like every big name in Hollywood. It was absolutely hilarious. And we're like, okay, well, that's a little different league than we're playing in.
That's hilarious. Kelly, before we wrap, I have two questions for you. The first one, a lot of people know certainly Barry Trotz as the head coach, but you played against him when he played with the Regina Pats on that team with, I guess, Flockhart would have been on that team.
Yep.
Of course, Doug Wickenheiser, and we all think of that, you know, the big points he put up in the Western League. How good of a defenseman was Barry Trotz?
He was a good, rugged defenseman. I'd say that the thing about Barry is that he came to play all the time. He was, you know, you talked about some of those other names, the so-called stars of that team, and they were a dynamic team. I still say, I'm not sure exactly what went on in that 1980 Memorial Cup final, but I swear that something goofy went on, because they should have won the Memorial Cup. They were an amazing team. But Barry was that kind of glue guy, the rugged guy, stay-at-home that made their team a whole lot better. But, you know, he shared a story with me that I was aghast to learn, and this might have been, about 1998, maybe one of his first years with Nashville, and I was at that time working for Hockey Night, and because we had lots of brawls versus Regina, like tons. They were the people, or they were the team that beat us out in the Eastern Conference Final in 1980 and went on to the WHL Finals and then to the Memorial Cup. But one time, I guess, I don't know what happened, but there was a big brawl in my crease, and I'm throwing punches because it was crazy back then. It was mayhem. And he came in, he left his point position, came in, and somehow he got knocked to the ice, and he was kind of turned over. His stomach was kind of on the ice, and I'm really disappointed in myself, but I'm going to still continue to share this story, how mean the game was back then and how despicable I could be too. I guess I had taken my skate. I saw that his back of his leg was exposed just above his skate, and I slashed him with my skate. And he ended up getting some stitches, and man alive, I mean, he's still got a scar from that, he says, and I was just horrified by my own actions. So that's what kind of despicable human being you're talking to right now.
Well, it's nice to see you've changed.
You haven't gone out with me on a Friday night.
Thankfully for your colleagues. And last one, and it's always, you know, it's always an interesting moment when a player gets traded. And when you went from the New York Islanders to the Los Angeles Kings, did it soften the blow considering you were traded in history's first all-medicine hat Tiger trade with Mark Fitzpatrick and Wayne McBean going the other way?
Yeah. That was a shocking moment in my life, and actually Doug Crossman was added to that. There was futures a part of that, so Doug Crossman ended up going from L.A. to New York also in the summertime because we ended up going to the second round of the playoffs that year. But I didn't know Mark Fitzpatrick very well, but Wayne McBean I've since gotten to know, and man alive, is he ever doing well. He and his family, they own a whole bunch of golf courses in Alberta and in the Phoenix area, all around Arizona, if I'm not mistaken. And so, yeah, it's been cool, and we kind of joke about it at the time, and boy, as you can tell, I've just loved this conversation. Going back to my time with Medicine Hat, it's life-changing, right? I was a 17-year-old, really shy, naive kid that only 1 year earlier I'd been on my first ever flight from Edmonton to Vancouver with my midget team to go watch a Vancouver Canucks play of all teams in New York Islanders right in around the Christmas holidays, and I ended up making the Islanders. So that whole 4 or 5 year time frame for me was quite a journey, and I everything changed for me in those few years.
Well, listen, it's been a delight catching up, Kelly, and continued success with the Calgary Flames broadcast, and continued success with Hockey Night. Thanks for doing this.
You got it.
Yeah, thanks so much.
I'll see you down the road right away, boys.
The Junior 2015 NHL Draft Tracker.
All right, Sammy, time for our Draft Tracker segment each and every week here on the podcast. This week up for grabs, someone we'll see on Friday Night Hockey, former Don Mills Flyer and first-round draft pick of the London Knights, Mitch Marner, 5'11", 165, and don't look now, but 28 points in 9 games in November. He is blazing through the month, Sam Cosentino. Your thoughts on Mitch Marner, 17 goals. That includes 4 hat tricks, by the way.
Not particularly sharp the first 10 games of the year. I think maybe 5 points, and it started to worry me a little bit. But you know, you've seen this happen so often, Jeff, where you know, someone gets a little case of the draft blues, and you're worried more about what's going to happen in June than you are about what's going to happen in September and October. And I think that was definitely the case for Marner. But you know, there's no denying that the talent was there. We saw it a little bit last year. Now playing frontline minutes, it's all of that stuff that we expected to see. Being a year older, physically and mentally, has started to come to the fore. And this guy's he's been dynamite. There's a lot to like about his game. A lot of subtleties, the ability to put pucks in areas that most people wouldn't want to go to. So. You know, I love his game, and I love how it just continues to grow and grow, and you know, just looks like another first round pick that is in the London Knights uniform.
Yeah, I want to ask you how high you think he goes, and still plenty of hockey to be played before the NHL draft in June. But you know, someone else who I know you really think highly of on that London Knights team is Christian Dvorak, and him and Marner have really formed a nice little battery for Dale Hunter's squad, haven't they?
Yeah, and you know, Dvorak missed a good chunk of the year last year being hurt, and still ended up going in the second round. But for Marner, I'm just gonna go lightly, tread lightly right now, and say top 15. But wouldn't surprise me at all if he were to make it into the top 10 by year's end. And who knows? I think you'll start hearing his name being mentioned with top 5 picks by the time you know, we get to the draft. But as it stands right today, I'll just go easy, and I'll do the you know, the price is right where you bet the dollar, and I'll say top 15 right now.
Well, yeah, I remember sitting with you last year at Budweiser Gardens in London, and you know, we're talking about how, you know, some of the 95s for London were having a hard time in the tournament, but Mitch Marner seemed to be bringing it every single shift, almost as if he was trying to say, it's not my time yet, but as soon as next year hits, this is all going to be about me.
Yeah, it was like the pre-stage, if you will. And it looked to me, when you talk about the 95s and I wouldn't, you know, Horvat and Domi in that group, you're looking at guys that they'd look tired. They looked like they'd played a lot of hockey, like they hadn't had many summers off going back to the 2012 MasterCard Memorial Cup run in Shawinigan, then of course in Saskatoon, and then, you know, hosting with having been eliminated, I think, in round two. And those guys looked like they had played almost too much hockey. Whereas for Marner, he accepted it. Okay, this is my big pre-stage, if you will, before my draft year. And I thought he and Dvorak were really good in the MasterCard Memorial Cup. And it doesn't surprise me now to see him on the kind of tear he's on.
Well, and interesting as well, and we'll transition to previewing our Friday night hockey game this week. This was supposed to be a rebuilding year for the London Knights, but not so fast, even though, you know, they're not going to get Nikita Zadorov back. And we all saw the news with Willie Desjardins and that nice little bit of video welcoming Bo Horvat to the Vancouver Canucks. This is still a team that can really do some damage around the Western Conference, and we'll see them front and center against the Erie Otters on Friday night hockey. Are you as shocked as many are that London is as competitive as they are this year?
I am, but I also look at, you know, there's a couple of big free agent signings in there that really kind of help fill out the roster. And that's what Mark Hunter, when he was in the job, was really known for doing, the ability to fill out rosters with free agent guys or lower draft picks that he'd kind of hothoused or kind of sat in the weeds waiting to happen. And I think the same sort of thing has happened there. But I'll say this, I think Aaron Berisha has been a nice add. And I think Michael McCarron is starting to take the kind of steps that Jared Tenorti took. Because when you look at McCarron's entry into the London Knights a couple of years ago, the same way Tenorti did when he came from the U.S. program, you thought, boy, this guy's a first-round pick. I mean, he looks like a deer in the headlights. The skating doesn't look like it's right. All of these things. And now you're seeing McCarron really apply himself. And you're starting to see a lot of the same things that Trevor Timmins and Mark Bergevin did when they drafted him in the first round a couple of years ago. And so when you get guys like that making big steps, when you get guys who've kind of been there before, i.e. Dakota Mermis, who else is in that group? Matt Rupert, guys that have been around a little bit. Of course, you have Domi, who's a fantastic player in his own right. Christian Dvorak is healthy. So at first look, you say, well, how is this going to play out? I mean, is this going to be a London Knights rebuild for maybe the first time in the 10 years that I've been calling games? At the start of the year, it sure looked that way. But as the players who've been there in the past have kind of made quantum leaps, Mitch Marner, no question that he's made the quantum leap. Domi's back. That's huge. All of these things start to add up, and you say to yourself, okay, and they're even getting some saves in goal. And I think that was probably the most important thing is kind of getting that situation shored up. And I'm not necessarily sure this is exactly how it's going to look, depending on how London goes. But Parsons and Gigavots have done a good job in kind of sharing the role there. And they're, you know, they're actually being effective for London. When you look on paper at the start of the year, how can an underage guy and a guy who's kind of bounced around and been in and out of prominence in Peterborough do the things they've done in goal, and it's worked out to this point.
It sure has. I was glad you mentioned Michael McCarron as well, because it almost seemed as if at various times last year, the Montreal Canadiens organization would kind of look at McCarron and say, we really hope we didn't throw away a first-round pick. We hope we didn't throw away a pick at a Louis LeBlanc, and that this guy with that size and that potential was going to be able to transition into the NHL. And this really is the first time that we're seeing Michael McCarron have that ability. Or you can look at him and say, you know what, I can see this translating into the NHL game. He's always going to have the size. And when you're facing off against the Boston Bruins as much as Montreal does, and I think he was asked about this on his draft day as well, you're going to need that size. But this really is the first time we've seen McCarron really put everything together in a package.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know what? I'm going to go back to Tenorti again, because both came from the U.S. program. Both were big guys. Yeah. Both were first-round picks, both to the Montreal Canadiens. And Tenorti's coming-out party to me was playing for the U.S. at the World Juniors in Calgary and Edmonton. And I watched him do things there that I hadn't seen him do in London. And, of course, he finished out the year there in fine fashion. And those similar strides, I think, really from the start of camp for Michael McCarron have worked out that way. And so he looks, it's almost to me, it's almost the exact same path, other than one's a defenseman, another one's a, you know, a forward.
All right, we'll see the London Knights face off against the Erie Otters, who are all of a sudden figured out a way to play without Connor McDavid. Although, and you know, you look at that first game that we had 2 weeks ago on Friday Night Hockey against the Niagara Ice Dogs, it seemed as if something wasn't right with McDavid out of the lineup. DeBrincat really brought it. Ryan Strome had a good game despite not being able to produce the way he's been accustomed to so far. But this is a team that now in the last week and a half has really hit their stride and almost said to themselves, okay, now we know how to play without McDavid, and we're just going to keep on rolling along.
Well, you can't look around and say, well, who's going to do it tonight, because he's not there. And so you have to take that upon yourself. And I give a lot of credit to Dylan Strome and Alex DeBrincat. Those are two guys who, as young guys, have accepted that responsibility. Now, getting Joel Weigel back has helped, although he's not 100%. Mason Marchment has been an unbelievable surprise. You got Kyle Pettit, who's about as steady a guy as you can have to really help settle things down. Nick Betts has had an amazing year. I think the back end has been better than expected. And probably the biggest, you know, addition there was getting Curtis McDermott back from Manchester. That was huge. And then the other thing that you can't forget is Devin Williams has started to play now. He started to play the type of game that saw him unseat Oscar Danson as the number one goalie in Erie last year. That's also been key for Erie, who lost the first two games without McDavid, have won the last three. And, you know, as I spoke to some people around Erie earlier today, that, you know, they're going to look at London as a big test.
Yeah, it's become an early measuring stick game already for the Erie Otters. Someone on the back end as well, who you know had a number of injuries, seems to have shaken them, and is starting to hit his stride. He was close to being invited to summer camp by Hockey Canada, and that's Travis Dermott. What do you make of number 44 on Erie?
Yeah, really like him. Late 96 birthday. I know they love him there, and he's been battling some injury issues through the start of the year, but. Yeah, he's a steady guy who can play, you know, a physical brand. He can, you know, he defends well, but still has the ability to put up some points for you too. So you're talking about a defenseman who has that all around game, and I think Dermott is the guy who can do that for you.
You know, I watched Mason Marchment, who, by the way, is the son of former NHLer Brian Marchment, playing Coburg, and he was Sammy. He was tiny. Like you want to look at the player who had that late growth spurt. That's Mason Marchment, because the guy that I saw playing Coburg is nowhere close to the player that we're seeing now for the Erie Otters.
Got amazing hands, really. He does, and it's funny. I remember talking to Tim Burke, who's the head scout for San Jose, and. You know, Brian brought him out to watch Mason. Was it last year, maybe even the year before? I think it was in Coburg last year, actually. And Tim Burke kind of looked and said, "Hey, you got something going on here. Like, there's some good things happening in his game. We got to work on his boots. I think the boots are still a bit of an issue, but they have come a long way, much like his height." And so he now is a guy with those type of hands. And the other thing is this, Jeff. When you have a good player who's just starting to learn to come into his own, he's cognizant of what's going on. I mean, his dad scouts, he knows what's happening. He knows that there's going to be someone in the building every single night that is going to be able to see him simply as a result of watching McDavid and Strome. And that's a huge boost for a guy who's very well aware of his surroundings, like Marchman, having grown up in the game.
You know, I want to ask you about Alex DeBrincat as well, who's had a fantastic season for the Erie Otters. Born in, I want to say, Detroit or around the area, went to a prep school, Chicago, not drafted. The London Knights were very interested in bringing in Alex DeBrincat. Erie made, put together, you know, a nice education package for him. He ended up signing with the Otters, playing with Connor McDavid, of course, now playing with Dylan Strome. The knock is always going to be the size. But when I watch him play, it's not as if he shies away from traffic. He goes into it. There was a moment in the Erie London game, not that far, far back, where he went right at Michael McCarron. And it was Davian Goliath. Like, here's this highly skilled squirt, for lack of a better term, going up against one of the biggest players, not just in the OHL, but the CHL. And DeBrincat wouldn't back down. What do you make of Alex DeBrincat?
As a small guy, you better have a good stick. And I don't mean that just for scoring goals and making passes, but you better have that little bit of a nasty edge to you. And I look at a guy like Paul Byron, Tyler Ennis, is another guy that I think about going back to his days in Medicine Hat and now, you know, playing fairly well for the Buffalo Sabres as guys who have kind of learned to adjust to the pro game, the NHL game, by being able to be just nasty enough that you can defend yourself so that you can't be taken advantage of. In junior, it doesn't always happen. You need some guy who can stick up for you or whatnot. In the NHL, that happens not quite as frequently, Jeff, obviously, as it used to.
Yep.
But you still have to be able to kind of defend your own turf. And having a good stick for a little guy is a good way to go about doing that. DeBrincat's got he's got good edge to his game, though. You know, I was really impressed. I mean, you know, of course, the first thing people are going to say, well, yeah, you're playing with McDavid. Look at the power play, 10 out of his 22 goals, I think, have been scored in the power play. Yeah, it's easier with McDavid, whatever else. But he's applied himself quite well without McDavid. He's a small guy with a lot of edge. He's got skill through the roof, shoots the puck really, really well for a smaller guy. And so, you know, moving forward to next year's draft, that's going to be I think people will have seen him enough this year to realize that he has the ability to play a little bit bigger than what he is. And if not, when projecting him to the pro level, that he should be able to at least handle himself. And I think that's going to be a big asset for him moving forward.
Yeah, he'll be an interesting prospect come NHL draft in 2016. You can watch the Erie Otters and the London Knights on Friday Night Hockey a couple of days from now on Sportsnet.
I'm Jonathan Drouin from the Tampa Bay Lightning. I play for the Halifax Mooseheads in the Major Junior League.
All right, Sam, as we wind down the very first edition of Junior, the CHL podcast, we'll finish up with the BMO CHL Top 10 rankings for Week 10 across junior hockey. And, Sam, we have a new number one, considering the Kelowna Rockets lost a pair of games to Portland last weekend, one of which you saw on Friday Night Hockey. No surprise they've dropped down to number two. Your new number one, Michael Del Cole, Ken Appleby, and the Oshawa Generals. Your thoughts?
Yeah, isn't that something? It'll be easy. It'll be interesting, rather, to see if they can maintain now with the announcement of Cole Castles being suspended for 10 games. You know, he's such a huge piece of that Oshawa team. So, you know, a little bit more reliance on Appleby, a little bit more reliance on Del Cole. But I think DJ Smith's done an amazing job there. And, you know, he is really going to make a case for making a move to the next level. I know there was some talk about him moving to the American Hockey League as early as this year. But he comes back, and this Oshawa team, who I surely didn't expect to be as good as they've been to this point. So I think here we are, Week 10. As the number one team in all the Canadian Hockey League, there's no doubt that that's a bit of a surprise for me. Kelowna back-to-back losses against Portland. You know, Erie rebounds after the McDavid thing with a couple of losses there once it was realized that he'd be out, but then responding with three straight wins. The Brandon Wheat Kings remind me of the St. John Sea Dogs going back to 2011, and that they're probably a year ahead of their time, but still a team that I think is a real threat to play in the MasterCard Memorial Cup this year. Rimouski getting Samuel Morin back has been huge. St. John and Sault Ste. Marie, you know, they've just kind of kept the drum roll going there. And Kevin Constantine, defensive hockey. Don't tell him I said that, because he wouldn't buy it. Bacomo, you know, having transitioned to a new coach there with Marco Pietrangelo. And then, of course, the Medicine Hat Tigers. I mean, a perennial Western Hockey League, Eastern Conference top two or three team. It's amazing how they're able to do it year in and year out. Maybe that's the ghost of Kelly Rudy or something. I don't know.
we should mention as well, honorable mention to Blainville Boisbriand, London Knights, and the Quebec Ramparts, host of this year's MasterCard Memorial Cup. I want to rewind to the Brandon Wheat Kings, because they talked about trades at the beginning of the podcast today. They go to Saskatoon for the goaltender that beat them last night. Alex Moody comes in. Not the greatest numbers, but he's not exactly playing on the best team. Your thoughts on the Wheat Kings move to bring in the 19-year-old goaltender?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, they're obviously familiar with them. The Blades and the Wheaties have been trading partners in the past. Braden Chen, although it was with Lauren Mullican as the general manager of the Blades at that time. But In Moody's case, I think he was kind of on pause. He was on pause in Saskatoon. The goaltender numbers in Saskatoon are brutal right now. And so Bob Woods has come in there and he said, listen, let's just go with two young guys. Let's remove one of these guys from our situation to maybe inspire the other two guys to open up the net and say, hey, someone take it and someone run with it. I think, he was looking for an end game of a save percentage around 900, and it surely is not that area right now. So moving Moody out of the mix makes a ton of sense for Saskatoon. And getting a veteran guy who knows he's going to be in and be a backup to Jordan Paperny is probably the perfect thing. That should things falter or injury or whatever else, you know you have a 19-year-old that you can rely on. And we know how much stock that that general managers put into 19-year-old guys.
Hey, Sam, you know what team's a freak to me? The team that most recently reeled off 10 wins in a row, that's the Armada. Can you explain Jean-Sébastien Giguère's squad?
I can't. I can't explain it. I wish I could. I had some conversations with some people. They're not unlike the Medicine Hat Tigers in that they're a small, speedy team that works their tails off. And to think of some of the talent that's left there, you know, they're getting Samuel Montembeau has been really good in goal form. So that's been a huge help. I really thought, though, I got to be honest with you, Jeff, when JF Uwe left, I thought there was going to be a drop-off there. But I have to give a ton of credit to Joel Bouchard, who's the owner, the general manager, the Hockey Canada thing, and whatever else, that he's been able to coach this team to being as good as they've been, 14-7-1-2 at this point in the year is really amazing to me. But they do remind me a lot of the Medicine Hat Tigers, and maybe they're, you know, maybe they're kind of trying to establish that sort of thing. I know they had it with JF Uhl, but it's been fascinating for me to watch that same thing carry on with Joel Bouchard now at the helm.
All right, Sam, again, congratulations to the Oshawa Generals. This week, the number one ranked team by way of BMO's CHL Top 10 rankings in Week 10. And don't forget, Friday Night Hockey this week, the Erie Otters travel to Budweiser Gardens to face off against Max Domi, Mitch Marner, and the London Knights. Sammy, that's it. Maiden Voyage is all done. We look forward to next Wednesday, and we thank everyone for listening either at sportsnet.ca or downloading us on iTunes. Great job, Sam. We'll see you in 7 days.
Awesome. Look forward to it. It's been great.